Hello, friends. Today on the podcast is Patrick Roan. We delved really, really deep into minimalism, technology, using a Mac. We also talked a lot about depression, loving each other, passing on positivity to other people. It was a really, really good conversation. I really enjoyed it. I would urge you all to listen to the words that he says and take in the conversation and dig into some of his books. But without further ado, please welcome to the podcast, Patrick Roan.
Very true. So how are you?
I'm very good. Yourself?
Oh, I'm exhausted.
Oh, that's not good.
The situation is that, long story, but we own 4 houses.
Okay.
People keep dying and leaving houses. And so we have 4 houses. And it snowed here fairly significantly, enough that, it needed shoveling, not just, a nice light shovel, but get the snowblower out. I've spent the morning driving around doing that to 4 houses, which literally takes all morning. So, it's not just hauling the snowblower in and out of the back of my car and everything else. It's also, there's certain things you can't snowblow, like steps.
Yes.
And, certain pathways. Not, so those you have to shovel. So, not easy. But
no, it doesn't sound it.
No. And I've got a deadline of tomorrow for a magazine article I'm writing, and haven't really paid it much attention other than a little bit last night. So.
Oh, dear. Sorry. Is that kind of interfering for a little bit?
No. It's all, everything will happen when it is meant.
Oh, that's good. I know that's definitely your outlook on life anyway, isn't it? Just let things happen. I guess I'm quite lucky that I don't really have to deal with much snow in this country, which is always a good thing.
Yes, exactly.
So, just rain, just lots of rain. I don't know whether you've ever been to the UK.
I have been to the UK several times, lots of times, in fact. Not only have traveled there for vacation purposes, but also used to work for a company that expanded into the European market by buying another company, and this company had offices in Brussels and in Bournemouth.
All right.
Okay. And so I traveled back, and I was in charge integration of that transition.
Right. Okay.
I traveled back and forth, both to Bournemouth and to Brussels, for about a year, or maybe more, a couple of years, many times.
Oh, so you got the best part of the UK anyway. It's quite nice.
Well, it's a nice little seaside town, kind of a little retirement community, actually. It seemed. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, you definitely are. The kind of standing joke is that a bus turns up outside your house when you get to a certain age and you just have to move there. It's like written into law.
You have to go to Bournemouth.
Yeah.
I don't know why it was that this company, like that was where their office in the UK was, but, especially considering that their other one was in Brussels.
Yeah, what a strange place. Bournemouth and Brussels, I guess, do they like the letter B? I don't really know.
Apparently so, maybe. But, they could have chose Brighton. They could have chose,
definitely.
There's lots of Bs in the UK. It's not like there's any shortage of towns that begin with the word, with a B.
And they're probably easier to get to than Bournemouth as well.
Yes. Our hour and a half bus ride was never fun, but they did sell Kit Kats on it, which was nice. So they don't sell candy on our buses here.
No, I bet they don't. They've been exposed to British chocolate already. A lot of my friends that move out there or whatever, they come back over here, they take like a suitcase full of Cadbury's chocolate and stuff all back with them because it's just not the same, is it?
Nope, not the same at all. And hobnobs. I'm kind of obsessed with hobnobs. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Let's just say that your cookies, or shall we call them biscuits, are much nicer there than they are here.
Oh, right. Okay.
We don't have hobnobs here.
You don't have hobnobs.
No digestives.
Oh, you got to have a good digestive biscuit. There's nothing wrong with a good digestive biscuit and a cup of tea.
How else can you drink your tea without one? I don't know how.
A good digestive biscuit should drink half of your tea for you, really.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I don't understand how you can drink tea without a good digestive biscuit.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I know how either. That's why I don't drink the Yorkshire when I'm out of them. I drink Japanese tea instead.
All right, okay.
So, in any case, so yes, I'm very very familiar with the UK. My daughter considers herself an Anglophile. She absolutely loves and adores London, and I hope to bring her back. Sooner rather than later.
Right. Okay. It's like a rite of passage for Americans, isn't it? To visit London and all those sorts of things. But trying to explain to people that there's a UK outside of London is often quite difficult. Most people are familiar with London, possibly a town on the south coast, and Manchester, and I think that's about it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I've had the chance to at least see some of small town. Or smaller town, UK. But I really want to. I've never been to Scotland. I'd really love to go to Scotland. I'd love to go over to Wales. I mean, I'd like to see more of the country. I'd love to see Liverpool.
Yes.
And go down. I'd like to go north. I'd like to go south. I'd like to see the whole thing. But outside of London, between London and Bournemouth, I've been kind of stuck with that. So
I suppose with you've got the luxury really of being able to travel and I say quote unquote work from anywhere with your writing and articles and all those sorts of things, you can pretty much take yourself on the road.
Yes, this is true. But at the same time, my wife, while she also is a consultant, it's not nearly as easy for her. Right. And obviously we have to work around our daughter's school schedule as well. But we really strongly believe in travel being a important part of a child's education, that we should get her out of this mess of a country as often as we possibly can. And so we do try to take her out of the United States at least once a year, if not several times a year.
Oh, good.
And actually for her, how old was she? She was 8. For her, at age 8, we actually did London, Paris, and New York City all in one year, which was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of traveling
also,
as well.
Also, my daughter is one of those young ladies who she is surprisingly sophisticated for her age.
Okay.
And so that makes her wonderful to travel with, number one. Number two, she's absolutely fascinated with history and loves history.
Oh, great.
Number three, she absolutely loves art. And so she's the sort of kid who, like when we went to Paris, we went through 15 museums in 7 days.
Oh, wow.
And that was just a part of the trip. We also went on walking tours and we went on, we spent a whole day in Versailles. The whole nine yards. Right. And she's that kind of kid that you can those things with.
That's fantastic. I mean, she's already like a middle-aged woman in a little girl's body, then, I guess.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Nothing more than that. I mean, my little lad, he's only 7. He's absolutely obsessed with history. But we're having kind of a bit of a tussle at the minute because, rightly or wrongly, our educational system, you kind of get taught the same sorts of things, and there's only so much you can learn about, like the two world wars that we were heavily involved in, should I say. And they, yes, they tend to, there's only just certain periods of time that they teach. It seems to go from like knights and castles and stuff to the world wars and then Victorians, and that's probably about it. Whereas there's just a vast wealth of stuff out there, which he dives quite often. We have to take reading books and stuff off him to try and get him to be childlike, if you like, to
kind of
relax and just do those normal things. But he loves nothing less than just like learning stuff. He's obsessed with it.
Oh, that's great, though. That is really great.
Which is, well, judging from most of the children that he interacts with and picking up bits and pieces online, it's quite rare for kids to have that at an early-ish age, I guess. I don't really know. I guess it's wrong to tar people with the same brush, but we're all led to believe, certainly by the internet, that kids are obsessed with mobile phones and all that sort of stuff. So it's great to hear that we're both having not those experiences, should we say?
Yeah, no, and that's certainly not my daughter's experience. Her usage of such things is fairly limited.
I guess she's got a good teacher, though, hasn't she?
Well, but it's not necessarily because we are doing it consciously. It's because she's got as busy a schedule as we do, and she just doesn't have the time for it.
Right.
You know, she's involved in circus, you know, European style circus. She goes to a circus school.
A circus school, right? Okay.
It's not like her regular school. She does this after school, but. But it just so happens that here in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live, is the largest performing European style circus school in, well, North America. Our program is over 1,000 kids taking classes and ranging in age from, well, 2 to 22. So, yeah, and that alone is 3 nights a week, 6 classes.
Wow.
So, yeah,
she really doesn't have the time, does she?
No, she doesn't have the time. you know, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. She's also involved in Girl Scouts, and she does Norwegian dance with a Norwegian dance troupe. And, you know, it's yeah.
So you've got, like, she's got like a full-time job outside of school to keep up with all her activities and stuff.
Gosh. Exactly. Yes.
The strange things that kids can get interested in. Hey, it's bizarre, isn't it? But that's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes our traveling involves circus as well.
Which sounds like a bizarre statement, doesn't it?
I know, really. But when we went to Iceland, one of the things we did, and the reason we were able to kind of write off the whole trip, was we met with a couple of the heads of the Icelandic circus, who are trying to start a youth program there, and my wife actually is the business manager for the circus school that Beatrix goes to. That's one of her many clients. And I'm the lead volunteer rigger, so I coordinate all the rigging for the acts and for the performances. Mm. And so because of, and my wife also has done other consulting with other circuses around the world. And so oftentimes when we go places, we can incorporate some business into it too. And kind of write it off, which makes it kind of nice.
It's a business expense, I swear.
So I suppose at some point we should probably get to recording this darn thing.
Huh? I suppose it's kind of the idea of doing a podcast. But to be honest with you, I've shied away from, more traditional things, you know, with like your cold opens and your introductions and all that sort of stuff. And I just decided with all the other podcasts that I do are very sort of traditionally technology related, you know, like topic to topic to topic. And I just decided that I really wanted to have a conversation with interesting people. And
yeah, I like it.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, having read a couple of your books, you're very much focused on kind of having conversations, whether it be face to face or online with people, as long as it's done in the right way, I guess. And it was quite interesting to hear you on, I forget what the podcast was called actually, recently.
I know the one you're talking about with Erica Boucher.
That's the one, yes. And that was the whole reason why I was just like, oh, Patrick does podcasts. I'm going to message you. I'd followed you on Microblog for a little while, which tends to be your usual hangout. And I was just like, wow, let's have a conversation with somebody that I kind of followed for a while, read all your books. And it's a bit cliche for me to say, I guess, but I first came across you, which I'm sure everybody completely does, in the Minimalism documentary. I stumbled across it by complete accident on Netflix. And I've heard quite a few people saying, when I've been kind of reading other interviews with you and other podcasts and stuff and listening and taking all the information, that I'm not alone when I say literally the documentary changed my whole outlook on life. And it's a strange thing to meet somebody. I mean, I guess you would say you only had a few clips in it, wouldn't you?
Yeah. What's, kind of amazing, and I should see if I can find a way to send this to you, if possible. The story behind that is actually somewhat hilarious, because Josh and Ryan, I've known them for a while, mm-hmm. and I was kind of into the whole quote unquote minimalism thing long before they came along, like back. When they were still working at Verizon. And so what was fascinating and interesting is that they, recorded me for 3 hours.
Right.
And there's about 3 minutes in the film. So
yeah, I didn't actually realize there's your voiceover for a reasonable amount of time over clips. And I didn't actually realize what little screen time, I guess, you had until I rewatched it the other day.
Yeah. I'm barely in there, but I will say that I like the, I like what they did with it.
Yeah.
If you buy it through on minimalismfilm.com, if you purchase it through Vimeo, you get all of this bonus content with bonus interviews, and there's a 20-minute cut of the interview that they did with
me. Oh, it's okay.
Which is, I think, well worth watching. And watching, I mean, it's worth like $20 or $10. I forget how much it is to buy the film, but you buy the film, you get all this bonus stuff, and it's more than worth it. Because the bonus stuff provides so much more context when it comes to this stuff. And I think, speaks about things on a much deeper level.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I do have mine uploaded somewhere.
I found it. Yeah, there's 29 minutes, just over 29 minutes of you. You can buy all of the kind of interviews, which is actually quite a considerable amount. I mean,
There's a lot there.
There's sort of like 40 minutes with Sam Harris, and Leo's on there for another half an hour or so, and that's the equivalent of £7.63.
Yeah,
it's nothing. That's
a no-brainer.
Yeah, right? 7 hours there is of footage altogether.
I mean, that's a meal at McDonald's.
Yeah.
So no, seriously, in the UK, McDonald's is kind of expensive.
Yeah.
But you also don't have to deal with people. You can order everything from robots, which is great. We still have people here. But yeah, no, I think it's well worth it, and worth buying and kind of investigating some of that stuff by itself. Yeah. In any case, I digress.
So how you were kind of starting to touch on how you became involved in it?
Well, they approached me about like, hey, we're working on this film, right? Yeah. Uh-huh. We could use some additional footage, and we were wondering if you were going to be around in late December. I'm like, yeah, sure. Yeah. We really think you're kind of part of what we're missing. 'Cause they actually had done several versions of this film.
Okay.
you know, they did kind of a shorter version, and then they did a kind of film festival version mm-hmm. that was a fair bit shorter, that they entered into a couple of film festivals right. And it was received well. And so they decided they wanted to fill it out more before kind of throwing it out there for a kind of wider audience distribution, and especially for Netflix.
Yeah.
So, I was kind of one of the few people they kind of asked to be a part of it at the last minute for the, kind of final feature cut of the film. The funny thing is that I live with I live with two maximalists.
Yeah, I've got a couple of those myself.
I'm able to practice minimalism only to a certain extent. Yeah. And only when it comes to my stuff. Because you're talking to a guy with four houses. I'm sorry, forgive my French, but for the UK listeners, four bloody houses. And it's impossible to be a minimalist in the circumstances in which we live. Yeah,
it's definitely difficult, isn't it? Most people kind of associate minimalism with reasonably affluent, bordering on middle-aged single guys, don't they? They just kind of, that's the usual association. It gets wrapped around Silicon Valley quite a lot, doesn't it? Though the sorts of people that have... very well off, should we say. I mean, obviously, Leo's got six kids, hasn't he? And it's kind of shown that it is possible. But everybody else has a completely different outlook. And I said that the documentary changed my life in the way that I kind of viewed things. And that's the way that it is. Because I'm really glad I kind of stumbled across it late one night whilst just looking for something to entertain myself. My daughter is disabled, and she has quite a lot of sleep problems, so she keeps us up quite a lot. So one of those nights I was just watching this documentary, and it was just like turning on a light switch. But unfortunately, I still live with somebody that likes things, and it's kind of finding that balance, isn't it?
Right. Well, and I'll get to that in a second. But just to wrap up on the story. So they decide to come and interview me in film.
Okay.
The day after Christmas. Right?
Yeah.
Not only is the house kind of in a Christmas like explosion mess,
it's not very minimalist at that stage, is it?
Yeah, right, exactly. that we still have yet to clean up from. But the other thing is that, the day after Christmas here is a big shopping day, right? It's a day where you go out and you return and exchange things that maybe didn't fit, or, whatever you didn't want or what have you. You go take care of that. But also, there's tons of places having massive sales mm-hmm. because you're going to be in the store buying things, and they've really got to get all this Christmas stuff out and start preparing for like the next holiday that comes. And so, they're having massive sales to get rid of stuff, especially any of the Christmas stuff is, 50-75% off. And so it's a good time. Like if you need more wrapping, cause you've used it all up for presents for this year, well now you can, buy the wrapping at 75% off and keep it until next year. Right. So it's a time to take care of those good deals. So perfect. My wife and daughter have plenty of returns to do and shopping and everything else. So they make themselves scarce and leave the house, and I tell them, I probably only should take this not long, blah, 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 blah. Here we are about 2.5 hours into it. And here we are in the middle of the interview about minimalism. And here comes my wife and daughter in the door, literally both of them. Bags and bags and bags of shit, right? This is
honestly, I can't even make it up.
Most unminimalist thing, and I am just mortified, so embarrassed, But I mean, I've known Josh and Ryan for a long time, and they know that that I don't live with minimalists and that I don't live in a minimalist house.
Yeah.
I don't live, you know, the most minimalist house we have is the one my dad lives in, actually, that we own, which is one of the ones I was shoveling today because he's out of town. But let's just say that it was just quite the contrast of subjects when here I am doing this interview about living with less and, you know, finding what is enough for you and kind of holding yourself to that, being grateful for what you have and all these things. And here they come through the door with loads of crap. It's just so hilarious. Just
because it was on sale.
Yeah. Which you'll notice, like every shot of me, even when you watch the extended interview, is a tight shot because they don't want to, like, if they zoom out or show like my home or show me just sitting like literally the table is full of our Christmas china, you know, like, you know, the background is still has all those, you know, all the silver boxes from us putting away the silver after Christmas and things like that. Mm. So, yeah, it's just
the complete opposite of every other house that they showed on the documentary.
The complete opposite. literally the 180 degree difference. The what not to do. You know, here I am sitting there talking about that stuff, feeling like a complete fraud.
Maybe it's good that they only put you in there for like 3 minutes then.
Exactly.
But that was really my first, I guess, the words exposure to yourself. And I looked into loads of the people that took part in the documentary because I wanted to find out more. And then I read a few books. I read Enough of yours, which was, I like this kind of collection of kind of small essays that are kind of bite-sized and easy to digest because they're thought-provoking. And I think that the right kind of flow is to kind of read one and then think about it afterwards. You don't feel like you have to get into paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs of stuff.
You're using it as I intended.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I mean, I'm an essayist. I just don't think in books. Well, that's not entirely true. I do have one that I've been working on for a long time, but I've been working on it for a very long time because I don't think in that way. I think in vignettes, right? I think in kind of bite-sized nuggets. Mm. And so, yeah, my intention in writing and formatting things that way, you know, some may say, well, you know, he's just taking a bunch of blog posts and basically, you know, put them together as a book. Well, okay. The same could be said for, you know, George Saunders and his short stories, right? Mm. You know, it's like,
yeah, this, I mean, is not, most things.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, this is not necessarily some different thing I'm doing here or just doing something stupid and easy. I'm doing it because that's the way, that's what I write. That's what I do.
And I think that's the correct approach. It's just makes the book more approachable in my sort of opinion. I mean, if you were to pick the book up and flick through it, you would find something almost straight away that you kind of just start reading and 30 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes, you're at the end of the chapter and it's just kind of, okay. And it gives you the opportunity to kind of, it's kind of interspersed with your little quotes and stuff, just gives you time to think about what you've just read. Because so many books out there are just loads of prose or whatever it is. And it's just kind of like point after point after point after point. And in the end, it gets tiring of those kind of things of almost somebody telling you what to do.
Or, you know, what I often find with many nonfiction writers who are writing about a, you know, a particular single subject for 250, 300 pages is that there's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of, you know, okay, the point I'm trying to make in this chapter is this. So I'm going to state my point and then I'm going to give example after example and, you know, simile after simile. And we're going to, you know, come back around with metaphors and then we're going to restate the point, you know, and it's like, well, that could have been like you made your point in the paragraph and it made perfect sense. Ooh. You didn't need to just keep beating me over the head with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I get it. I get that you really did research this stuff and you did, you know, you want to include like your sources and things that you, whatever, I get that. But, you know, let's be honest, this could have been a couple of paragraphs. It didn't need to be an entire chapter, right?
No. Yeah, I agree.
And this, you know, this could have been, you know, a book about many things. Instead, it's, you know, you're the same thing that you're trying, you know, basically you have 20 ways to make the same point, a point that you could have made in a page. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not to knock. But I mean, because there are certainly some books, you know, that are nonfiction that I love, but I find a lot of them to be that. There's one that I keep picking up and trying to read and then keep putting it down and being just like, I can't get through this. I'm not going to name it. But let's just say that it's a subject that I'm passionate about. It certainly is something that is, you know, something I believe in, and that sort of thing. But for whatever reason, maybe it's because I'm familiar with a lot of the subject matter and a lot of the ideas and concepts that he's putting forth, or, you know, but I just find it to be kind of, you know, like, oh, okay, I get it already.
Yeah.
You know?
It's tiring, isn't it, after a while?
Yeah. And I find myself like skimming it as opposed to really reading it. Then yeah. I feel bad about that. So I put it down and stop altogether.
Yeah, I get that as well. A lot of the time you end up, you're just like, yeah, I kind of know what's going to happen, but there's two more paragraphs left in the chapter. Do I skip it or give it the attention it deserves?
So I'm glad you know, I mean, you're using the books the way that I meant them. Yeah, I meant them to be the sort of thing that you can just pick up, spend a few minutes with, and have something to take away.
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely one of my favorite books that I read on the subject. I mean, I dived literally headlong into it because I was very much engrossed in this kind of buying things to make myself better because I could, and all those sorts of things. So. It was good to see that. Did the book kind of start as blog posts or short essays or whatever? I know it talks a lot about your writing letters to people and emails to people. Did it start along those sorts of things and then you squashed it together?
Kind of. I mean, yeah. I thought about it as like, oh, okay, I'm going to write a blog post about this, but instead of publishing it to the web, I'm going to make it a little chapter in the book, right? Yeah. And I find that I actually write books when I can approach them that way. You know, isn't that nice? So that's true of enough. This could help. I actually had a newsletter that I sent out. It was a paid subscription newsletter called This Could Help. You know, I said up front, you know, I'm going to start this newsletter and the things I'm going to write there, I'm planning on compiling into a book. But by putting it out there and sharing it with you, you know, now beforehand, you know, you're paying for the privilege of getting a sneak peek of what's in the book. Number one. Number two, anyone subscribed to the newsletter will get a link to download the ebook version for free when I'm done. You know, since you've pretty much already gotten it, just not compiled together as a book. I'm going to take all of these things and maybe I'll combine them with a few other things that I actually did publish on the web. And maybe I'll take a few things that never made it out to the newsletter or the web, but I kind of just meant put in the book. And so you definitely will be getting something at the end of this that will be different than what you received, and the folks that may have read one or two of these things on the web, well, they're going to, you know, get a whole lot more that they didn't get to see. Right. And it made me feel like I wasn't just like repurposing content. I went into it with the stated goal of I'm going to repurpose this content.
Right.
You know, you are paying for the privilege of getting it before anyone else.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you put it into a book, it's all curated and all put into like a nice little order. There's bound to be some stuff in there that you've missed or it's going to be expanded on.
Even though there was one or two that slipped in somehow. The non-edited version slipped in, and I was like, "Oh gosh, I know where they are, and I cringe every time I hit them."
Oh, right. Okay.
I just don't feel like reformatting it, and I'll just leave it. Yeah.
I like the approach to this could help as well, because it really hits the nail on the head, doesn't it? So many books out there in this kind of, I don't want to say self-help kind of guise, but it's those sorts of things. And you just kind of take the approach of like, look, this is my opinion. Read it, digest it, and it might help. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not telling you everybody else does this and you're completely wrong. Here's the advice, as if I was some kind of grandfatherly figure or whatever the case may be. And it might help. And the title is absolutely perfect because there's so many things out there. I mean, I recently read a book by Aubrey Marcus called Own the Day. The guy's kind of like goes backwards and forwards into psychedelics and all that sort of stuff. But it was generally interesting to kind of read it. And it almost takes the guise of, I don't know whether you've read many of these, but for some reason my pocket cue thinks I'm some kind of like going through a midlife crisis or something. But it's all these posts like 10 things that Wall Street bankers do and 6 ways your morning routine will do all this. It's kind of like saying everything that you do is wrong. Here's how you do it correctly. And if you don't do it, you're not going to succeed. Whereas,
or that, you know, these 10 things are the absolute secret to unlocking the power. It's like, no, that's someone's idea of 10 things. There could be 10 other things, right?
Yes.
You know, I mean, I can give you the, some pretty good investment advice if you want some, but I'm not going to claim that it's the end all be all, you know, it's just what has worked for me. The fact that it also works for Warren Buffett is, besides.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess generally your outlook is just do less, have less things, love people more, and appreciate everything that goes on around you, which is almost the kind of anti philosophy that we're sold, isn't it? There was an interesting thing, not to keep going back to the minimalism film, because I know you were like a small bit in it. I didn't never realize how much, but there's a guy on there, I think in Las Vegas, that kind of says the ultimate minimalist is kind of like a hermit or a recluse or whatever. But those guys are the most dangerous because they live in this thing where there's nothing wrong with consumption, but we're just not listening to everything else that we're told about buying the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And that's like the most dangerous thing to, I guess, consumerism, isn't it? Kind of living not completely out of the way, but just being aware that we're being bombarded all the time with adverts.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, here I am opening up Skype for the first time in a while. And,
sorry, if you've got like 7 updates.
These advertisements flashing at me about things that I, it believes I need.
Yeah.
They're everywhere and they're constant. And I think that, this is kind of an aside, but it'll make sense in a second. For one of my New Year's resolutions that I was going to dress nicer.
Yes, I've seen your daily threads on Microblog, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Part of it is like, you're gonna like go out and buy all these fancy new clothes. Actually, my wife was the one who said to me, like, "Oh, this is gonna be an expensive resolution." I said, "Come on, honey." I said, "You know me." I said, "No. In fact, it's gonna be quite the opposite. The whole reason that I'm doing this is not only because, well, you and Beatrix both said to me when I was, we went down to my sister's wedding at the beginning of December, and my sister had an incredibly fancy wedding,
right?
Let's just say, and so I brought nothing but dress clothes with me because, well, we were there for 3 days, the plane ride down, then a kind of wedding party get together that night, the rehearsal dinner the following night, and the wedding the following night after that, and flying back home the following evening. So it's like, So it didn't make any sense to bring anything casual. I brought nothing but dress clothes, right? And my wife and daughter were like, wow, it's nice to see you all dressed up. Because normally I'm a minimalist when it comes to my dress.
Yeah.
Literally, I wear, at least before I made that the resolution, I would wear mostly pretty much the exact same thing every day.
Yeah. Right? Which most people that are minimalists, quote unquote, do.
It was just nice not to have to think about it. Yeah. I have six of the same charcoal gray t-shirts. I do the laundry in the house, so I kind of know the cycle in which I do it, and so I knew that six was exactly what I needed. A little vintage army shirt jacket that I would wear over that. And jeans, simple, right?
Yeah.
When they saw me dressed up every day, they commented to me several times how nice it was and how nice it was to see me. And I started thinking about it. I started thinking to myself, well, I have all of these other clothes that are not getting worn. And a lot of them are really nice clothes, right? And I found that when I was dressed nice for that, 3-day period and whatever, I kind of, stood up a little straighter, walked with a little bit more pep in my step. I felt a little bit more, put together, as it were. Yeah. As you Brits would say, I felt smart. So I thought about it. From that standpoint, here's the other point, and that is that I couldn't just get rid of like my suits and things like that. I actually do need them for the occasional wedding I need to go to, or the, like I said, my wife is a nonprofit business management consultant.
Yeah.
And so, there's a period a couple of times a year where we go to various fundraising galas every night and, things where I have to get dressed up for. I occasionally do speaking gigs, in which case, I put on a shirt and tie and jacket,
Mr. Fancy.
So here's all of these nice clothes that I own that only get touched for special occasions. And some of them I may not even wear for a year or two, right? Or three. What good is having that, right? I should just say, you know what? I don't need all this. I'm going to get rid of it like a good minimalist would do.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is really nice.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do that. And so the other thing is, show your appreciation, show your gratitude for these things that you have, these nice things you have, and use them. Right?
Which is what they're intended for. Yeah.
Which is what they're intended for. Right? And so a big part of that is just using these beautiful things that I have, not buying things, but actually using what I have. And in fact, a lot of what I have, because, besides the whole minimalist thing, I'm also, I wouldn't say I'm frugal or cheap, but, I like to get things, on sale.
Value
I like
for money.
The nice things I have, I like to keep a while. And a lot of the nice things I have, especially, I've had for a very long time. And even, some of those are like vintage things, right? Yes, all of this is to say that even that is kind of a micro statement. A statement behind the statement I'm making is to love what you have, to use what you have, appreciate it, have deep gratitude for it, and to reject this idea that you have to go out and get the new and the hot and the fancy, that you probably have things in your closet that you haven't worn because you think, I've got to wear it for this occasion or that occasion. No, you can wear it anytime you want. There's nothing that says that if you, work from home like me, you can't dress up in a tuxedo to do it.
Yeah,
why not?
Absolutely. There's no reason. I mean, it might feel a bit strange to start with, but I guarantee you'll be walking around the house better than you would do in your sweatpants and your hoodie. Do you know what I mean?
That's right. You know, and especially, you know, pour yourself a nice cup of tea and, you know, and fold that laundry with your tuxedo on and just see how much better, see what a difference it makes. I'm only half joking.
Yeah. This thing about, kind of consuming things just for the sake of it. I mean, as I put in the kind of talking points that I said, it's something that I used to struggle with no end, just because of adverts and people around me had new things. And even just like your New Year's resolution, where you would kind of make a thing, you're like, right, I'm going to dress better. The automatic thing for people is to go, right, we'll go shopping and buy a whole new wardrobe, when you've got perfectly good things in your wardrobe that you will probably throw out once you bring your new stuff home, and it doesn't make you feel any better.
Well, and, you know, I'll be the first to admit that I think way too deeply about these things, and I'm thinking deeply about this aspect of stuff, because I'm actually writing a magazine article for Josh Becker of Becoming Minimalist. Yes, has has kind of a you know, an e-magazine called Simplify Magazine or Simplicity Magazine, I forget. In any case, I'm subscribed, I have it, but he asked me to write an article for it, and they're doing an issue on gratitude, and so I've been thinking a lot about gratitude. And here's kind of where I'm at with that. This shirt I'm wearing, this flannel shirt that I'm wearing, probably took, I'm guessing, maybe several hundred, if not close to 1,000 people to make. And you're thinking to yourself, oh, come on, seriously, one shirt? No, that's not true. Well, no, it is when you think about it. Because when you think about it, sure, there was the, you know, seamstress probably in India or China or what have you, who sewed it. And then it probably wasn't one. It was probably at least a dozen, because, you know, it's assembly line style. You have, you know, one who does the buttons and another who does the hems and another who does the sleeves and another who does this and that and the other, right? You have the machines that, you know, wove the fabric. That's not done by hand anymore. That's now done by machines, which is great, but still those machines have to be operated by a machinist, you know, or by an engineer. You know, someone's got to sit there and operate the machine. So now we're up to maybe 13, 14 people to put together the shirt, and that someone had to build that machine. And that machine was probably built in a factory with a whole bunch of workers and stuff like that. I'm guessing maybe about 50 people, possibly up to 60, touched that machine in the process of making the machine that wove the fabric, right? But those threads had to come from somewhere, right? You know, the fabric isn't just made out of, like, thin air. It actually comes from, in this case, cotton, right? Mm. Cotton that had to be harvested and picked. And grown,
yeah,
right,
and cared for and harvested driven to the factory and all those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, oh, and we haven't even gotten to the fact that this was done in you know, factory, maybe two or three different factories, in fact, and that those factories had to be built by literally hundreds of, if not thousands of people. And now let's talk about that machine that wove the fabric, because that steel didn't just come, you know, out of thin air. It had to be mined by miners who mined the steel that went to a steel foundry that then took those raw materials, made them into steel. You get what I'm saying? Yeah. The screws that held the machine together, all of those screws had to be machined. You get what I'm saying?
I do. You've just blown my mind.
Thousands of people went into making this one flannel shirt that I'm wearing right now.
My mind is officially blown.
I mean,
and that's probably a conservative estimate. I have a tremendous
amount of gratitude for that, right? A tremendous amount of, like, now that I realize that just taking this and getting rid of it to replace it with a nice dress shirt is literally throwing away the work of thousands of people, saying that that doesn't matter, saying that's not important.
Just because you can.
You know, just because it doesn't, quote unquote, fit my style anymore, or, you know, because it, you know, it whatever. Right. Mm. And so I can't do that. And I can't really do that with anything, because guess what? Everything is that way. The simplest of objects took at least a few dozen people for you to be able to enjoy.
Yeah, without a doubt. When you start thinking about everything that you touch on a daily basis, it's like millions upon millions of people, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Right? And it gives you a whole new appreciation and understanding of what it takes to live the life that we live, and to own the things that we own, and to, you know, and to love the things that we love. It causes you to love them even more, and to appreciate them even more, because you understand that they're not just a thing, right? They're a result. And that they are the result of someone's effort, someone's labor, someone's dedication, and someone else's care and concern that you have this thing. Not necessarily specifically you, but anyway, you know, and quite frankly, the seamstress in China who's sewing on the buttons on the next shirt right now is probably not thinking about, oh, this is going to be for somebody. But guess what? It is. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything is connected.
Mm. I'm always really concerned with all this kind of like fast fashion. We have a chain over here. You probably have something similar in the States called Primark, which is just ridiculously cheap. And I mean cheap both in terms of monetary value and quality of what they sell. That's just not taken care of. The stuff is just all over the place. And
if you're a girl and you need some fleece leggings, I can't think of any better place to get them. They're so cheap. Yes.
Every time I kind of go in that place, I'm just like, somebody is making this stuff that is so far undervalued. I mean, what do you pay the workers when you can buy clothes for this cheap? It's just, it feels dirty to me.
But at the same time, you know, just, you know, one has to put that in perspective too, right? That worker, that may be the only job that's available to them. That job might be the difference between their family starving and their family eating, right? No matter, and
I'm
you know
saying,
what,
take the fleece leggings job away from them, but surely we can pay a bit more and pay them a bit better.
that would be lovely.
If a lady can have two pairs of fleece leggings instead of 10, and they're made better, and we pay the person in India better, then surely everybody's happy.
But yes, that would be lovely.
It seems to be getting worse.
It definitely is getting worse. And, you know, but once again, everything is connected, right? It's this, you know, part of feeling the gratitude is also letting go of the Western shame and guilt over that, right?
Yeah.
And the reason being is because, like I said, that would be lovely. Unfortunately, that's not what we as consumers are demanding, right? We as consumers are demanding, in fact, lower prices, right? My oven downstairs that I cook on every single day was built in 1953. It's made out of, you know, solid, you know, cast metals, iron and steel, you know, and, you know, covered in ceramic. You know, it's built like a tank, right? And it's from 1953, and it still cooks and operates as if it was brand new. And the reason for that is because back long ago, when you were going to buy an oven, you were going to buy that oven once. And that oven was going to last you your lifetime.
Yeah.
And therefore, that oven cost Maybe half a month's salary, possibly a full month's salary.
But right? You only had to do it once.
It was a significant expense, and you were going to only do it once, right? But it was very, very expensive. It, you know, it hurt when you had to go buy an oven. Like, you know, you were going to be making some choices about, you know, how important it was to actually have food to cook in that oven versus, you know, having the oven itself and having to decide between the two.
Yeah, you might not have anything to go in it, but you've got a nice oven.
But you're going to have an oven, right? But so that said, it was very expensive in comparison. But over time, you know, the demand from consumers was, no, we don't want an oven that's $1,000. We want an oven that's $500. And so the company said, well, all right. Well, okay. We can make a $500 oven. We just have to cut the quality of the materials in half. And now it's not going to last you for your whole life. Now it's going to break down in 10 years. Great. We don't care. We want the cheap oven.
Yeah.
So you got the cheap oven, right? The truth is that an appliance like an oven or a washer and dryer or whatever, if you want them to last for a very, very long time, and maybe even for your lifetime, you can buy those. It's just going to cost you way more than you want to spend for such a thing. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You can buy a $20,000 or $30,000 stove. This is not, you know, this is pretty easy.
It still exists.
Sub-Zero, Wolf, you know, brands like that make those sorts of ovens. There's some German brands that are, you know, up in that range, and those will last you a lifetime. They will be professional level quality ovens. But you're going to pay $20,000 or $30,000 for them. Oh. Right? And so I guess all of this is to say that if we want a change in this department, we have to demand it. We have to demand it by not spending our money on the cheap stuff, by demanding the higher quality, and by be willing to say, hey, I'm willing to not buy the, you know, $3 to a package fleece leggings at Primark that are going to last me for a season. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to pay $10 a piece for them and be happy with that. And they're going to last me for 3 seasons, 5 seasons, right?
Yeah.
We have to find what is quote unquote enough in that as well.
Yeah, very true. It's not everything is to blame on adverts and stuff, but they certainly breed it. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about just lately is obviously this consumerism with the technologies that's kind of around us now is kind of like almost enforced. I'm not saying they put timers in there for it to break, but they certainly make it very, some brands do, but
some brands do, other brands don't. Other brands is just the way it is, right?
I mean, yeah, it's just they kind of make it. I don't even know what the word is, but all of a sudden, because the new one's out, the old one just doesn't do what you want it to do anymore. So this is definitely what you need, this new one, even though your old one works perfectly well. You need a brand new one, and you can show it off to all your friends and you'll feel like $1 million because you'll have the new one, but the old one, the old one can just be thrown away or whatever. It's strange, isn't it? I guess it's weighing everything up, isn't it? Do I want to spend $30,000 on an oven and it lasts me a lifetime, or do I want a $500 oven that might last me 3 or 4 years? It would almost be a question with no answer, wouldn't it? It's almost kind of like, of course, people will opt to spend a fraction of what they want and are okay getting one every so many years. Or
yeah, well, and for me, I mean, you know, my answer to that question, and that is that
you know, just because they come out with a new thing doesn't mean the one that's in your pocket suddenly doesn't, it stops working or stops doing what you wanted, what it was doing yesterday, right? That you don't necessarily have to chase after features, right? There will always be new features. There will always be new things that come along. Mm. And just because they do, it doesn't mean that this thing that you had before suddenly stops working. It doesn't. You have a choice. I resisted upgrading my iPhone. I used an iPhone 5 up until about, I want to say about 6 months ago now. Mm-hmm. When they finally rolled, when they discontinued the iPhone SE is when I went out and finally bought. because my iPhone 5 was doing everything I needed a phone to do.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly everything I needed a smartphone to do.
I think it's one of the little essays in Enough, isn't it, about features? This whole kind of about lined paper and adding in features that are overcomplicate things and often limit its usage.
Yeah.
Quite a vivid picture that you painted in the mind with obviously like a blank piece of paper being almost limitless potential.
Yeah.
You put lines on it and arguably you're adding a feature, but you're actually limiting its usage now because you can only use it in one direction. And then when you start adding in boxes for dates and all sorts of stuff, adding in features is not always a good thing, is it?
No, sometimes you're taking away possibility when you add features.
Yeah that's it.
Yeah. In many ways, I think that holds true for technology as well. Just because a feature has been added, oftentimes it's adding a level of complexity or it's adding, adding something that's in your way, something you don't need, something you don't, half the apps that come on in the iPhone out of the box now built in, I never use. I'm sure some people do. Some people use the stocks app. I'm sure if you're super interested in the ups and downs of the stock market, or if that's part of your job, you probably are really married to the stocks app. I never use it, right? I don't use the Find My Friends thing. I know where my friends are. And most of them are on the internet, so I don't need to find them.
Don't need to find them.
No, I don't need to find them. I know where they are. I can find them when I want them. I'm sure if I ever get stuck in the woods somewhere on a hike, the compass will come in handy. Until then, I haven't launched it. But you get what I'm saying, right? Some of these things are just kind of just taking up room. And
I guess that's really what Minimal Mac was about. It's a blog that I would have completely missed, but you posted north of 2,000 posts, basically, with guides and stuff on how to use the Mac and everything that's built into it. And a lot of the time.
There was a lot of that.
Yeah,
we believe in.
The next application that you need that's infinitely better than what you download Word and Excel and all those sorts of stuff, and you kind of dedicated quite a large portion of your writing time to actually teaching people that, most of the built-in stuff is absolutely fine.
Yep, perfectly fine. And I believe it till this day. I write a lot of my blog posts in TextEdit, so that should tell you something. I don't need anything more than that. Why would I? It's a freaking blog post. It's not, I'm not reinventing. I'm not doing page layout or anything like that. I'm writing some words down. I think, just like with consumerism and advertising and trying to sell people an idea of what who they are and who they should be, I think applications and features and technology does the same thing, right? It sells us an idea of who we should be, right? you know, Facebook is built around the idea that we should be connected to the rest of the planet, right? Mm-hmm. And that's who we should be. Twitter is built around the idea that, you know, even our most fleeting of thoughts should be shared, right?
Yeah.
That it's selling us as much a lifestyle and an ideal as it is, a thing. And in return and trade.
Product. Well, it's not always selling you a tangible product. It's selling you an idea that they can then use for advertising at a later date.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, and you're feeding them a tremendous amount of data to, you know, basically train their artificial intelligence to deliver even more appealing ads to you. So yeah, it's
and that's all we want, isn't it? Just more ads to manipulate us, better ones, ones that know everything about us. We're only a few years away from literally just like talking directly to us. Surely adverts. Facebook have just a ridiculous amount of data on us. They must just know every single movement and bits and pieces.
And how dangerous Instagram advertising, just simply because they really do, because they've got the pictures and the text, they really you know, if you even show even a passing interest in fashion, the advertising that they start showing you is completely like, you know, all sorts of shirts and pants and shoes and travel gear. And like, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane.
Instagram was one of the first ones that I dropped in terms of moving away from thingies. Not because I didn't really get that. I think I obviously left before the real kind of Facebookification of Instagram, if that's even a word.
You just made it up.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm digging to it. Trademarked.
There you go.
But they've. It's always been very. I don't know whether manipulative is the word, but you're showing a passive interest in something, and if you go into that kind of discover tab, it just bombards you with loads of the same stuff, loads of kind of real shady adverts that are probably like a Shopify store that's just a drop shipper from somewhere, really low quality stuff. And even the celebrities and stuff get involved now, don't they, with kind of advertising stuff and not really advertising stuff. So it's really manipulative in the way that they go about stuff.
Completely.
And I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know whether, I'm sure somebody will correct me when the podcast comes out, but I think it's the most detrimental to mental health. I would presume because of the kind of visual element. There's certainly a lot of scantily clad ladies and buff gentlemen that kind of parade all over it. So I would imagine that's probably the case.
It certainly can be. I don't get the scantily clad ladies and buff gentlemen. Oh, right, so okay. I must be doing something wrong. I must be using it incorrectly.
Yeah.
So let's see if I can correct that. I'm very, as I'm sure you will probably guess, kind of mindful with my usage of these things.
Yeah.
And I do a fair amount of work to kind of ensure that I see the things that that I want to see and nothing that I don't. But it does take some active maintenance to do that. And also, it takes mindful usage of these things.
Mm, it does.
Right? I'm not just on Twitter just scrolling through things. Yeah. Right?
Unfortunately, I am. Twitter is like my vice, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why. It's just not something I do anymore, just simply because there's just so much sadness and division and hatred. And just like
there right is now. I think it probably arcs back to what you said before, that they've I keep saying they, it's not really the right word, but the people that are invested in Twitter have sold us this idea that every single thought that you have needs to be kind of published and out there.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, I get it feels good to, you know, go on and, vent about the president, or, you know, shake your hands at, in your guys' case, Theresa May for, you know.
For Brexit. In all fairness, it's not her fault. It's two guys' fault that kind of left her in it. But she's been like left holding the baby, should we say?
Yeah, exactly. It's a baby she didn't want to hold in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's not a baby she wanted to hold, but now she kind of has to, and she doesn't know what to do. No. And every time she tries to do what is the most okay thing she can do in the situation, everyone hates her for
it. Yeah, it's a lose-lose situation, isn't it?
It really is. It's so sad.
Yeah. Oh,
I feel so bad for you guys because it's just ridiculous. It really is ridiculous. Yeah,
it is ridiculous. I felt strange when, obviously, you guys had the American election. And then for us to go and kind of do a similar sort of thing, it was genuinely shocking to me that we decided we were going to leave the EU. I didn't individually. I understand there are people out there that voted for good reasons, but I'm just convinced that because of a lot of this manipulation now, and I guess a lot of it happens on Facebook, I think we were sold an idea that just isn't the case. And I say we because we are left in it. The majority of the country was sold an idea that just wasn't true. It was just an outright lie. And a lot of it was based on very small section of society having very strong ideas and very strong views that unfortunately have backfired on us all. So it's a strange situation to be in, but yeah.
Same, very similar thing here, as you know. So yeah, it's, you know, that said, once again, that's just another piece of evidence that, you know, nothing we do and nothing we own and nothing we consume is done in some sort of vacuum. It doesn't just happen out of thin air. It is a result, and it is a result of many people's labor and their connections and gratitude and appreciation and failure and right, then, quite frankly, that's the problem that you're having with kind of coming to a Brexit deal because you're too connected. It's too intertwined.
Yeah, it is. It's a relationship that idea of nationalism is all terrible anyway. I mean, what patch of dirt you're born in doesn't really make a difference, does it? But we're all kind of intertwined as individuals and then as collectives and then as societies and as countries and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a case of going, oh, we're not part of you anymore.
No. It's quite frankly, you know, there's only a little channel that separates.
Yeah, I mean, people can swim it, for God's sake. You know what I mean?
Your island from the rest of the world, right? You know.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we are in this strange situation where, similar to America, where a lot of our stuff that needs to be shipped in and manufactured in other places, and we're kind of stuck without it. We have no oil. We have gas, I think. We have a bit of oil in the North Sea, which I don't think is drilled by us. And our natural resources are very, very sparse. So we, like you say, we're an island in the middle of nowhere. And we seem to think we're an island that we can just look after ourselves. And it's just not the case. We should love each other a little bit more, I should say.
And quite frankly, it wasn't before the EU, right? The whole purpose of the EU was to make it easier for trade between the various nations, because you were not an island unto yourselves any more than France, you know, is, you know, some sort of country that doesn't have, you know, basically open borders with every other country around it. You know, this is not like, you know, I've got friends that have, you know, hiked from France to Germany to, you know, wherever, you know, and not cross a single border crossing. You'd hike over some mountains and guess what? You're in a brand new country.
Yeah, exactly.
And so how do you pretend that you're this separate entity from, you know, literally the people right next door?
Yeah, well,
you can't.
Clearly the answer is build a wall. It's bizarre. It's just this arbitrary line on a map just divides people so vehemently. It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
So there's if you've ever looked at a map of Minnesota, and I know we're way into the weeds here, but this is going to make for a great podcast. if you look at a map of Minnesota, there's a little part up at the top that kind of juts out in this very kind of strange manner, you know, just almost slightly, you know, looking at the shape of Minnesota slightly to the left, just this little piece that kind of juts up and comes back down. And that little piece is, and there's conflicting historical information on this, but it's thought to be a mistake. It's a mapping mistake. It was, you know.
Oh, yeah, like a little, just a random little bit that sticks up for just no apparent reason.
Yes, exactly. And the line was supposed to go across the 49th parallel. And that goes above the 49th parallel for this little bit. And the thought is that, you know, basically the surveyors who were, you know, kind of mapping the border back at the beginning of this territory, basically made an error.
Oh yeah, because there is actually some maps that if you just Google search it, there is some maps without it, because it's like a dead straight line and then just a little bit sticking up.
Yeah, just this little bit sticking up, right? And so there's actually been some talk about that, basically correcting that error, and giving that little piece of land, I forget how much it is, you know, certainly it's, you know, let's just say it's about, you know, a few hundred thousand acres, giving that piece of land to Canada, taking that. And one of the running jokes here in Minnesota is how many people are going to move into that little section of land.
That all of a sudden becomes the most expensive land ever purchased.
Exactly, because everyone will be running. Canada, please take me, take me into your loving arms, Justin Trudeau. oh land of universal health care. Oh land of you know, friendly people and you know, and toques
and apologizing
and poutine. Yes, take us please. We no longer want to be a part of this mess.
It's not that bad. Well, I suppose it is. You've got another 2 years to go, haven't you?
Oh jeez. It couldn't go fast enough, and who knows how that's going to go.
How's the feeling going? Is it generally still a bit depressive around there? Is it generally just like you still can't believe what goes on? And
I don't know. It depends on, you know, who you are.
Who you talk to, I suppose.
How you feel about it. I mean, we have a country much like yours where there is a significant number of people who are perfectly happy with our current administration,
right?
Okay. Right, yeah. And are supportive of the wall and all of this other stuff, right? And I'm not one of those people. I don't talk about politics.
No,
especially don't talk about politics.
Well, we'll move off it.
And the reason being is because, you know, it's just too personal.
Yeah,
and
it is.
You can't have these conversations in, you know, in a series of tweets or a Facebook post. You actually need to sit down with somebody, preferably with whiskey in hand, and like have, you know, deep and respectful conversations about it with an openness to understand and to learn where they are coming from. Right.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I have, you know, I'm not necessarily a pro gun person myself. I'm not a, you know, Second Amendment, you know, guns rights sort of person. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have those here in the U.S. But I actually have friends who do. I have friends who are. I have friends who are like serious, like, you know, what most on the, you know, kind of liberal side of the equation would consider gun nuts.
It's not two words you want together, but yeah.
Yeah. But I respect them a great deal. Hmm. I've had deep conversations with them about their feelings about it and the whys and the this, that, and the other. You know, and here's what I can tell you about them, and that is that, you know, the two people that immediately come to mind for me, although I have more, are perhaps the most responsible firearms owners I know. They are people that that keep their firearms locked up in safes and dismantled when they are not in use. They regularly, like every weekend, every other weekend, go out to the gun range and actually use them, get better at them. It's a tool like any other tool. Yeah. And because this is a potentially lethal tool, you certainly want to get really good and really comfortable with it, right?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Because it's not being good and not being comfortable with it that leads to accidents and death and unintended consequences. And they keep up their skills. You know, and here's what I can tell you, and that is that if I'm, you know, in a situation where a firearm is required, there's no two people I would want more by my side.
You will run like the wind in their vague direction.
In their vague direction, yes. I've already talked with at least one of them of, like, if there really is another civil war in this country, you know I'm showing up at your doorstep, right? Begging for shelter. You understand that.
Right? Oh, yeah, you know? Without a doubt.
Like, you know, and they get it. So, that's it. You know, it may not be my thing, but I respect them. I respect their feelings about it. I respect their rights to own those things. And I understand that if we really want serious change in this country, it's going to take those sorts of conversations. Yeah,
it's a conversation, isn't it? To me, there's nothing better than a deep and meaningful conversation with somebody else that has an opposing viewpoint.
Yes.
Also respectful for you. I mean, those conversations are, I'm not going to lie, quite hard to come by a lot of the times, but I can have a conversation with somebody that has a complete opposite viewpoint to mine, but I actually find it quite interesting to find out why they have that kind of viewpoint and what took them to make this kind of stand and whether that results in me changing my opinion. It's happens sometimes, but there's nothing wrong with just being like, we both agree to disagree, but we both have come away from the conversation more educated and wiser.
Well, and you know, hence, you know, wrapping this back around so we somewhat stay on topic, is what it comes down to when you're a minimalist living in a house with maximalists, right?
Ooh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I understand my wife's viewpoint on this stuff, and in many ways, I appreciate it, right? I've come to appreciate kind of her approach in a lot of situations.
Yes.
And she also has come to appreciate my approach as well, because we've been able to talk about it and we've been able to have honest, non-threatening conversations without, like, me thinking she's a horrible person for wanting to have this or that or the other thing, and her thinking that I'm, you know, that I'm some nutso crazy pants from wanting to throw every last bit of it away. But at the same time, like I said, throwing it away is a whole other, like,
yeah, it's not
consideration,
just,
it's not just, right?
As you know, as that, is it? No,
that is not necessarily the answer, right? No. And that there is a middle ground to be found between our approaches. And sometimes I need to let her have her way a bit. And sometimes she needs to let me have my way a little bit. But yeah, at the end of the day, we really are kind of after the same goal. And that goal is making the best life that we can for ourselves.
Yeah, that's it.
And most importantly, for our daughter.
Yeah. I guess the natural thing when you take a viewpoint is to defend it to the hilt and think people that don't conform to it are stupid. And these are the reasons why you should be doing what I do. Both me and my wife are in many ways completely different people. I mean, we butt heads on so many different topics, but it's a case of being respectful to one another and saying, I understand why you do this. And that's that. It's mm-hmm. Yeah, it's give and take, isn't it? It's a basis mm-hmm. where there's this myth out there where minimalists live with like nothing, where they kind of sit in the middle of the floor. There was a great Matt Diavella who shot the minimalism film, actually. He made a video that I was watched at the gym the other day on like my day as a minimalist, and it was a bit tongue-in-cheek. Was like, oh, I obviously doesn't have an alarm. It has one bowl, which is also his coffee cup. He has one spoon, one fork, one knife, sits in the middle of the floor cross-legged. There's this real myth with minimalists not having anything, but it's just about not having extra things. You still have stuff, but everything that you have is the very best thing that you can have. Do you know what I mean? It brings you
certainly
joy and value, I guess.
Yeah, that's the goal, right? The goal is, and that's why my book is called Enough. It's not called Minimalism. It's not called, get rid of all your stuff. It's called Enough. And one of the points I make in that book right up front is that enough is a very personal metric, right? I can't tell you what enough is for you any more than you can tell me what enough is for me.
No.
It is something that I have to kind of discover for myself. And a lot of that discovery is kind of done by a back and forth of paring down and finding I've pared down too much, so I need to add a little bit back more in, or getting too much and then figuring out, like my six charcoal gray t-shirts actually started off as three charcoal gray t-shirts. And then I found that, well, I didn't do laundry. At least I didn't do the darks every 3 days. I actually do them about every 5 days. And so that's why I have six. Wait a second. He just said 5 days. Well, guess what? Five are in the wash. I'm wearing
them. You've got a spare.
Yeah, I've got the one I've got on, and I've got the five that are now in the wash. And when they come out of the wash, you get what I'm saying.
That's
right?
That's not minimalist enough. You've got to do the washing naked, obviously. Yeah. in the tuxedo.
Exactly, in the tuxedo. So you get what I'm saying, right?
I do.
I do. Even reaching,
it's not having loads of stuff. It's just having enough, and enough is completely individual.
Yeah, and figuring out what that is for you and your lifestyle and your needs and your routine and your family and all of these other things, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, well, we have more than enough houses, but that's something
we're
trying to solve. and I think that that's the only thing that I really encourage people to do is to find what that is for them.
Yes.
That is not something that we are encouraged to do. We are not encouraged to do it by society. We are not encouraged to do it certainly by marketers. And we are not encouraged to do it by, necessarily, our friends and family and loved one, we have to decide on for ourselves. Yeah. Life is a bit more pleasant when I have exactly what I need.
Yeah. No more, no less.
No more, no less.
One thing I wanted to touch on, which is not something I've ever heard you talk about anywhere other than I was listening to Break the Twitch podcast. And it was, once again, you have this way with words and kind of putting things in that I've kind of my thought patterns in. You talked about the 300-pound piggyback guy.
Yes.
Which I'm not I'm not entirely sure. Was it a blog post originally, or is it something you've talked about in the past?
It's actually a blog post. If you if you just do a search of my name and the piggyback guy, you'll
just
find it.
Imaginative, I guess, way of talking about depression, basically.
Yeah.
And it's more and more relevant, I think, as society kind of goes on. And it's something that I've really struggled with, but I wasn't really aware that I struggled with it until 5 or 6 years ago. But I've actually been struggling with it like my entire life, in kind of peaks and troughs and all sorts of stuff. And it was just really weird to listen to that you were kind of describing a lot of things that I feel.
Yeah. Well, and I wouldn't have put it out there if I didn't think it was something that all people who survive with mental illness, especially depression, feel. But for me, that was just the best way I could describe what my experience
it's
was.
It's absolutely dead on. Obviously, that there is a piggy, a guy hanging around that wants a piggyback, constantly asks for a piggyback. Sometimes he's in the next room. Sometimes he's really breathing down your neck. But eventually, you kind of have to give in and give the guy a piggyback. And
that's when it's all over.
Yeah, exactly. And it affects you, everything that you do, because you've got a 300-pound guy on your back. Saps your energy, your motivation, makes you question your self-worth, all of those sorts of things.
It sucks.
And he kind of is individual to everybody else. He appears in different things. He's triggered by different things. You can fight him off as much as you like, but eventually you've just got to give that guy a piggyback.
Yeah. And that's, that's how it feels. I mean, it's something that I've, struggled with my entire life. I'm 51 now. I was diagnosed as, what was back then called manic depressive, but is today more referred to as bipolar. When I was 14 years old, I have been, in and out of professional treatment for that, most of my entire life. And even had a couple of bouts of, attempts at suicide, when I was much younger, that thankfully I survived. Not only do I know it from a personal level, but my oldest child is severely mentally ill. Not lightly at all. When I say severely, I mean is currently institutionalized. For being a danger to herself and others. It's something that not only I've dealt with on a personal level, but something that I've dealt with in a very familiarly personal way. And so I wrote that piece in an attempt to try to help those who do not suffer, who do not experience depression themselves, at least not on the active basis that those of us who live with it do, to try to help them understand what it's like and why we may behave in the ways that we behave sometimes. Why that thing, that simple thing we were asked to do, may have just been too much. Why we may have promised to come to that gathering and not showed up and not even bothered to call. Why we may sometimes just not pick up the phone. Or just not answer that email for months on end. because that one thing is just too much. And it doesn't have to be like, oh, it's a heart. No, it could be like, you know, hey, just check in to see how you're doing. That could be the one. Mm. That could be the one that we just say, you know what, I can't answer that.
I just don't want to open that kind of worms.
I don't want to.
Yep. Just not facing it.
I don't even have the energy to type out a response.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
And so folks could understand where that's coming from and what that's like and what it's like to
yeah,
to survive, so. Yeah. To survive that on a daily basis, on an hourly basis, on a minute by minute basis in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sucks.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I have a friend of mine who suffers with bipolar disease, and he's been institutionalized a couple of times now. And it's not a nice situation to be in, but
no,
that blog post or when you were talking about it on the podcast just really struck home, because I'm going to use that quite a lot when people kind of say, because depression, although it's, I'm solely convinced that everybody suffers from it in some form or at some level at some point in their life. I just don't believe that there is not somebody that doesn't experience it, even minorly. But a lot of people think it's just being upset or like down in the dumps. Oh, come on, cheer yourself up, that kind of mentality. And it's just not that at all. Quite often depression is feeling nothing rather than feeling down in the dumps. And that's what people find very difficult to understand. It's just, you kind of feel hollow, if you like.
Yeah.
It's just, there's nothing there in the kind of darkest depths. I mean, I talk quite openly about mine. My biggest bout really was triggered by my daughter, when you kind of battling those thoughts and feelings and stuff that surrounds it. I described it almost like a grieving process, really, where I kind of had to grieve for the child that I should have had, if that's the right word, or could have had. Because, of course, you go through all the pregnancy and all those sorts of things, and you kind of think about, oh, I'm going to do this and that, and they're going to be this and that, and you just have to come to terms with the fact that they're not going to be that.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to say that I am well through it and out the other side and have come to terms with all those feelings, but I'm definitely going to use this kind of piggyback guy, even if I share it with people or just point people in that direction, to just trying to explain it, because it just is, it's beautiful, honestly. It's to
thank you.
The descriptions and stuff in there.
Thank you.
It was just bizarre.
It'd be an honor. As you know, and as I say in many places, including in my books and my blog, I put these things out there in the hopes that they'll be helpful to just one person, And if it helps more than that, great. But that's my goal, is even if it just helps one, then I've done my job.
Yeah, without a doubt. I love the phrase that you use. Writing is how I try to make the world a better, friendlier, and stronger place. I like that.
Yeah.
I guess it helps you individually to kind of get those sorts of feelings out there, but it's your kind of thing to give to the world, isn't it? The words and stuff that are out there.
Yeah, well, and I really do believe, and this should have come through when I was talking about connections and things like that. I do believe that, even just making one person's moment, day, hour, week, month, year a little bit better has ripple effects, right? That it's, if I can put a smile on your face, you then are a little bit happier for your wife, who then is a little bit happier herself, who then is a little bit happier for your children, right? You get what I'm saying? And that all of this stuff is connected, and in the same way that the seamstress who's sewing on the buttons doesn't necessarily think about, like, the person who's going to be wearing that shirt.
Thinking about the person in the chain 8 steps down. You're just thinking about making one person happier.
Right. And that's it. But I also believe that by making that one person happier, that it will help people down the line.
Yes.
And that I really am changing the world. Right. We got to get past this idea that, that changing the world is this big, large thing that has these, you know, far reaching worldwide effects. No, the truth is that every step we take makes a difference, changes, literally changes the world, right? Like, you know, it changes the shape of the world. Like when we put our footprint in the mud, guess what? The world is a brand new shape. Yeah. But like that's, you know, that is, you know, that it may seem small and inconsequential and sure in the grand scheme of things. Yes, it is. But guess what? It all is. All of it is, yeah, right? Every last bit of it is. But then at the same time, every last bit of it also is another step forward, another part of the continuum, and another contribution to that we make while we're here, right? Mm. It doesn't matter if it's small. Everyone's small. I don't care how big it is. The iPhone, small contribution in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
Will be forgotten in 1,000 years.
Well, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, it doesn't. It really doesn't matter.
Nope.
But if everybody just like small positive things, it leads to huge change, doesn't it? It's ridiculous. I mean, just as simple as just passing on positivity and a bit of love.
Yeah, it really is.
That seems
sounds silly and quaint, but it's true.
Yeah, it does. It does sound stupid, isn't it? It's almost one of those old school things where it's just like smiling on the telephone and all those sorts of things that you kind of see from a few years ago. But there's definitely some knowledge in there that just those small kind of things. It's like a sea change, isn't it? It's like a ripple effect. Exactly what you said.
Yeah. Well, and the opposite of that is true as well, which is, you know, the reason why kind of engaging in, you know, even just, you know, even just viewing the kind of, you know, hatred and vitriol and, you know, the constant flow of the 24-hour news cycle delivering nothing but, you know, disappointment and death and destruction and everything else. That all has its own effect too, and its own ripple effect and its own effect on you and how you feel and then how that translates and ripples through those that you know and those that you interact with, right?
Yes.
That too has an effect, that it all matters. And it's both all inconsequential and extremely consequential at the same time. That it is, that is one of those things that, one of those ideas that we Buddhists like to call non-dual. Right. That it is both at once. Right.
Mm. That seems like a perfect place to wrap it up.
Well, thank you for thanks for this conversation. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Getting to know you. We covered so many topics.
Yeah, just ridiculous amounts of topics.
We had a major technical glitch in the middle of it, which I'm sure you'll figure out a way to edit.
I'll try.
beyond that, I thought it was good.
Yeah, so you're still hanging around Microblog.
Microblog. Yeah.
How do you get on over there? Is it generally positive? Generally, I think most of your stuff is post there and then kind of syndicated out to Twitter, isn't it?
Well, I don't even syndicate that stuff out to Twitter.
Okay.
I turned off, auto posting to Twitter for any number of reasons.
Yes.
I actually, almost everything you see on Microblog is stuff that gets posted to patrickrone.net and then, you know, forwarded to Microblog. So I funnel it through my own site first, as Microblog is kind of intended to do.
And that's, yes.
And in fact, that's the way that it works. You just don't realize it because it seems like you're using a social network. But in fact, even if you're using, if you're not running it through your own hosted blog, it's running through a microblog that is being hosted for you by Microblog.
Yes, you get micro.blog, don't you? Yeah,
right. Exactly. So yeah. Basically, I'm you know, I'm just running it through my own self-hosted WordPress site versus running it through Microblog. Mm. And yeah, I really enjoy the community that is being built there, and the intentionality that is going into the building of that community. They are being very careful and the community members themselves are being very careful of it not becoming Twitter.
Yes, and that's one of the things that you don't want is kind of, because that's the normal reaction, and I think that's basically what, was it Mastodon tried to do?
Yes.
Just kind of just made it an almost a kind of more open but a carbon copy of Twitter, and I find Microblog very engaging, and it never struggles to kind of get my creative juices going. Just by scrolling around it, I kind of just want to write something, which I really enjoy. Much as I'm trying to let go of Twitter, I can't quite do it just yet, although I've kind of got rid of the app, and I just make sure I sign out afterwards. It's kind of like intentional Twitter usage, but I really enjoy Microblog. I was in it from the start, and I kind of drifted away because it wasn't very good, and it wasn't very busy, and I couldn't find people to follow. And over the last 6 months or so, I've drifted back to it, and I think I'm sold on the kind of the concepts now. They've made a few changes and things like that. So, I mean, hey, we kind of interacted on there, so there's definitely mm-hmm. some good that's come out of it.
Yeah, see, there you go. Well, and that's the other thing too, is that it's a place that's still very friendly.
Yes,
right,
very friendly
in the way that Twitter used to be friendly, quite frankly. You know, friendly in the, you know, here's what I'm working on and here's what I ate for lunch sort of way.
Yeah.
And that there's value in that, right? There's value in the mm-hmm. kind of in the innocuous, but also there's value in just, hey, being friendly.
Yeah. I quite like, there's quite a lot of posts that's just like my daily gratitudes or whatever. Like, I was thankful for this and I was thankful for that, which sounds really... Yeah. I don't know what the word is, like hippie, isn't it? It sounds a bit like woo-woo, but it generally works because you kind of read it and you kind of go, oh, yeah, that kind of happened to me the other day, and, yeah, that was quite cool. It just generally puts you in a happy mood.
Yeah, yeah. Or just like, oh, that's nice for that person.
Yeah.
You know? And there's a lot to be said for that. So I like it.
Yep. So more users, please. Well, more of the same type of users.
But more folks who want to come in and build an intentional community built around the idea that A, you own those everything you post, and B,
without a doubt,
you know that people honestly want to form relationships with you and friendships, and that's important.
Yeah, it definitely is. Thanks for. Just putting the time aside to talk to me, Patrick. It's genuinely been a delight to have you on.
Oh, no problem. I hope this hasn't become like your longest podcast ever.
Oh, but, no, without a doubt.
I have a habit of doing that to people.
no, definitely not. I would love to have a chat later on down the line in another couple of hours of different stuff. So I'm sure we'll catch up again soon, but I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking to me. It's been brilliant.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome.